Good news! Goodwill Columbus has opened a new store in Westerville. And with a new donation center, it's easier than ever to make a difference in your community. Bring your gently used clothing, furniture, electronics, and more to our donation drop-off. Each donation and purchase supports our mission to provide jobs, free job training, essential services, and more right here in Westerville. Drop your donations off at 60 East Schrock Road or learn more at goodwillcolumbus.org.
If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
This is the 13th Juror Podcast, where we explore the trials, investigations, and true crime stories that everyone is talking about. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell, and this is Court Report, your weekly roundup of the biggest courtroom headlines, breaking stories, and the legal developments shaping the nation's most talked about cases. Before we get started, if my voice sounds a little different this week, I've been a little under the weather, but there was absolutely no way I could skip Court Report this week because there is way too much to talk about. So just try to bear with my voice and let's get into it. We're starting verdicts reached this week with a case that actually ended without a verdict at all because Lakin Snelling has taken a plea deal. Now, if that name sounds familiar, Snelling was a University of Kentucky student and a member of the school's stunt team when, in August of 2025, police were called to the off-campus home that she shared with roommates in Lexington, Kentucky. According to court records, early on the morning of August 27th, Snelling's roommates heard loud and unusual noises coming from her bedroom. Later that morning, Lakin told them that she had passed out because she hadn't been eating and said that she was going to get checked out by a doctor. But her roommates became suspicious. They went into her room, found evidence that someone had recently given birth, and eventually discovered a newborn baby boy wrapped in a towel inside a trash bag hidden in Lakin's closet. The medical examiner would later determine that the baby had been born alive and died from asphyxia by undetermined means. Lakin initially gave investigators a very different account of what happened. She said that she had unexpectedly given birth and the baby fell onto the floor of her bedroom. She said that she stayed awake for about half an hour after that, and then she either fell asleep or passed out on top of the baby, and when she woke up, noticed that he was turning blue and purple. She said she wrapped the baby in a towel like a burrito, which she said gave her some comfort in the moment. Then she went back to sleep until her alarm went off. When she woke up, she said she put the baby in a trash bag and left it in her closet. She admitted to cleaning up the room, putting items used during the birth into plastic bags, and concealing what had happened. She left her apartment to go attend class, but instead went and got McDonald's because she said she wasn't feeling well. By the time she got home, police were there to detain her for questioning. Lakin was initially charged with abuse of a corpse, tampering with physical evidence, and concealing the birth of an infant. But after the medical examiner determined that the baby had been born alive, a grand jury added much more serious charge of first-degree manslaughter. She pleaded not guilty, but last week that changed. Lakin appeared in court on Friday, August 21st, for what had been scheduled as a status hearing, and instead pleaded guilty to all four charges: first-degree manslaughter, abuse of a corpse, tampering with physical evidence, and concealing the birth of an infant. And during the plea hearing, for the first time, Snelling explicitly admitted that she caused her baby's death. Through tears, she told the judge that she had been under a lot of emotional distress and that the baby came unexpectedly. She said that instead of helping him, she ended his life.
I was under a lot of emotional distress, and my baby came unexpectedly. And instead of helping him, I ended his life. And afterwards, I cleaned up I'm going to tell you.
Okay. So tell me, when you say instead of helping him, you did what?
I ended his life.
How did you end his life, ma'am?
I deprived him of oxygen.
Okay. All right. And did you tell me about this tampering with physical evidence? What did you do with the evidence that could have been collected?
I put the towels in a plastic bag.
Okay. And what about this concealing the birth?
I didn't tell anyone after.
Okay.
As part of the plea agreement, prosecutors are recommending 10 years in prison for first-degree manslaughter, plus 1 year each on the other three charges. So if those sentences are ordered to run consecutively, that would total 13 years in prison. But that sentence is not final yet. Judge Diane Minifield said that she wants a pre-sentence investigation before deciding whether those sentences will run consecutively or concurrently. And if the judge ultimately decides to impose a sentence above the Commonwealth's recommendations, Lakin would have the option to withdraw her guilty plea. So after nearly a year of questions about exactly what happened inside that bedroom, including whether this newborn's death was accidental, Lakin Snelling has now admitted in open court that her baby boy was born alive and she intentionally deprived him of oxygen. Her sentencing is now scheduled for October 16th. Next up, we finally have a verdict in the first trial connected to the murder of Jared Breitigan. And if you've been following Court Report for a while, you know that we've talked about this case before. Jared was a 33-year-old father of four who was shot and killed in Jacksonville Beach, Florida, on February 16th, 2022. That night, Jared had taken his two older children, the twins that he shared with his ex-wife, Shanna Gardner, to dinner and then dropped them back off at Shanna's house. He was driving home with his two-year-old daughter, Bexley, when he came across a tire sitting in the middle of the road. Jared stopped, got out to move it, and prosecutors say that was exactly what the people who planned his murder were counting on. He was ambushed and shot. His little girl was still strapped into her car seat just feet away. For months, investigators had very little to go on, but eventually they connected the tire used in the ambush to a rental property owned by Mario Fernandez Saldana, Shanna Gardner's husband, and from there, they found Henry Tenen. Tenen had rented property from Mario, and investigators found Tenen's DNA on the tire rim from the crime scene. But there was another connection, money. Prosecutors showed jurors three checks from Mario written out to Tenen, totaling $10,000, written after Jared's murder. The checks had explanations written on them that made them appear to be for legitimate work. Things like roof repairs, landscaping, and even a business idea. The defense said that's exactly what they were, payments for work. But prosecutors said they were payments to a hitman. And the state argued that Mario did not have to be the person who pulled the trigger in order to be guilty of Jared's murder. Their theory was that this was a carefully planned murder for hire, that Mario hired Tenen to kill Jared as tensions surrounding Shanna and Jared's extremely contentious custody relationship continued to escalate. The defense pushed back hard on the motive. They argued that Mario didn't actually gain anything from Jared's death, and that there was no evidence of Mario ever saying that Jared needed to die or directly ordering Tenen to kill him. And there was one huge complication for prosecutors going into this trial. Henry Tenen was originally supposed to be their star witness. He had pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and agreed to testify against Mario and Shanna. But earlier this year, Tenen withdrew that guilty plea and backed out of the agreement. So prosecutors had to prove this case without the alleged gunman taking the stand and telling the jury that Mario hired him. And that's what they did. After roughly 4 hours of deliberations, the jury found Mario Fernandez Saldana guilty of first-degree murder and solicitation to commit a capital felony. He now faces a mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole on the first-degree murder conviction. His formal sentencing is scheduled for October 5th. But y'all, here's where this story takes a pretty incredible turn, because Mario's verdict came on Wednesday. Shanna Gardner's trial was supposed to begin just 5 days later, on Monday, August 31st. But then, almost immediately after Mario was convicted, we learned that he is now facing an entirely new criminal case. Mario Fernandez Saldana has now been charged with two counts of lewd and lascivious molestation of a child under the age of 12. According to the arrest report, one alleged victim told the investigators that the abuse began when she was around 8 years old and continued on multiple occasions. Authorities say that Mario is a suspect in a second investigation involving another minor. Now, these are allegations in a separate case, and Mario has not been convicted of these new charges, but their timing created a major problem for Shanna Gardner's defense. Her attorneys told the court that they learned about these allegations just days before her murder trial was scheduled to begin, and they need time to investigate whether they could provide an entirely different motive for Mario to want Jared dead, one that had nothing to do with Shanna. In other words, Shanna's defense is now arguing that these new allegations could potentially help them separate her from Mario's motive. Her attorney said 4 days just wasn't enough time to investigate that possibility and determine what evidence they may be able to put before her jury. And that wasn't the only issue. The defense also recently disclosed new expert witnesses who still need to be interviewed, and there's an ongoing appellate fight involving Jared's widow, Kristen, over whether Shanna's attorneys can obtain a forensic image of her phone. Prosecutors did not oppose the request to delay the trial, so the judge granted a continuance. Instead of beginning this Monday, Shanna Gardner's murder trial is now scheduled for May 3rd, 2027. And, as things currently stand, she is expected to be tried at the same time as Henry Tinnen. So after waiting more than 4 years for the first verdict in Jared Bridegan's murder, we finally got one this week. Mario Fernandez Saldana is guilty. But instead of moving immediately into Shanna Gardner's trial like we expected, an entirely new criminal case against Mario has potentially changed the way that Shanna's defense will argue her case and push that trial back another 8 months.
We'll be right back.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Haley Bailey. Okay, I need to tell you about something. I just got YouTube Premium. It's got tons of awesome features like offline downloads, so I can download my favorite videos before I travel and watch them whenever I don't have Wi-Fi. Because we all know airplane Wi-Fi is the worst. I get ad-free, I get background play, and there's like a ton more in there. You should try it. If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Try it now for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium.
If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
Looking for your next thrifting experience? Check out the new Goodwill Columbus location in Westerville. Our new store is full of the latest secondhand selections with options rotating daily. From warm weather clothes to home decor, you may find your new favorite items just in time for spring. Each purchase helps us create opportunities throughout Central Ohio. It's shopping that looks good, feels good, and does good. Come shop at 60 East Schrock Road or learn more at goodwillcolumbus.org.
When it comes to plastic surgery, expertise matters, and CAPS sets the standard. Our team includes 7 nationally ranked board-certified plastic surgeons. From tummy tucks, breast augmentation, and liposuction to facelifts and beyond, every surgical plan is tailored to your body, goals, and recovery timeline. CAPS is trusted for consistent, visible outcomes. Plus, when you book your surgical consultation, you'll receive a $100 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Expert care, exceptional results. Visit experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
Moving into appeals and legal twists, we have an update in the Carmelo Anthony case. Last week, I told you about what looked like a pretty significant victory for Anthony's new defense team. Remember, Carmelo was convicted in June of murdering 17-year-old Austin Metcalf during that confrontation under a tent at a high school track meet in Frisco, Texas. Carmelo claimed self-defense, but the jury rejected that argument, found him guilty of murder, and sentenced him to 35 years in prison. Since then, his new attorneys have been fighting for a new trial, and before that motion could even be heard, they successfully got the judge who presided over Carmelo's original trial, Judge John Roach, removed from the case. Part of the issue was that interview that Roach gave after the trial, where he was asked whether the jury got the verdict right, and he said, essentially, yes, they did. A visiting judge ultimately ruled that regardless of whether Roach actually could be impartial, his impartiality could be reasonably questioned. So Roach was recused, and retired Judge Michael Chitty was brought in to decide whether Carmelo should get a new trial. But this week, after a two-day hearing, the judge said no. Carmelo's request for a new trial has officially been denied. And there were a few different arguments from the defense. One involved public access to the original trial. Carmelo's attorneys argued that Judge Roach's unusually strict courtroom restrictions deprived Carmelo of his constitutional right to a public trial. But probably the most interesting argument involved something that we didn't know about during the trial. An off-the-record, quote-unquote, gentleman's agreement between the prosecution and defense. Basically, both sides had potentially damaging information about the backgrounds of Carmelo, Anthony, and Austin Metcalf that they did not want the jury to hear. So they agreed to keep all of that out and focus the trial on one thing, what happened underneath the tent that day. And during this hearing, we finally learned what some of that information was. We talked about this a little bit last week. Prosecutors revealed evidence that they said showed Carmelo had a history of talking about guns, knives, and fighting. But there was potentially damaging information about Austin as well, including prior fights and allegations that he had used racist language and painted racist graffiti. None of that was presented to the jury. And here's why that agreement became so important. Carmelo's original defense attorney testified that the plan had been for Carmelo to take the stand and tell the jury himself why he believed he had to defend himself. But the defense says a dispute developed over whether prosecutors would still honor that gentleman's agreement if he testified. According to Carmelo's new attorneys, that uncertainty effectively put him in a situation where he felt he could not safely take the stand without potentially opening the door to all of the damaging information against him. So Carmelo never testified. His new attorneys argued that essentially deprived him of the ability to fully present his self-defense case. The prosecutors strongly disagreed. They maintained that the agreement was honored and that nothing prevented Carmelo from testifying. The defense also challenged the jury instructions, arguing that the judge improperly instructed jurors about when someone who provokes a confrontation can lose the right to claim self-defense. Ultimately, Judge Chitty was not persuaded. In a very brief written order, he said that after reviewing the motion, the record, the evidence, the arguments, and the relevant law, the motion for a new trial was denied. So Carmelo Anthony's murder conviction stands, and so does his 35-year prison sentence. But this isn't the end of his legal fight. His appellate attorney says that they are moving forward with an appeal to the Texas Fifth Court of Appeals, and the issues raised during this hearing, including the gentleman's agreement, Carmelo's decision not to testify, and the public access restrictions, can now become part of that appellate record. So the defense won the fight to remove the original judge, but they did not win the fight for a new trial. And now the battle moves from the trial court to the Court of Appeals. All right, next up, we have another twist in the Brian Koberger case. Because despite pleading guilty and being sentenced to spend the rest of his life in prison, Koberger is now trying to undo that plea and get the trial that never happened. Remember in July of 2025, just weeks before his capital murder trial was supposed to begin, Koberger pleaded guilty to murdering the University of Idaho students Kaylee, Maddie, Zanna, and Ethan. In exchange, prosecutors took death penalty off the table. Koberger admitted in court that he deliberately and intentionally killed all four victims, and he was ultimately sentenced to four consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole, plus another 10 years for burglary. But last month, Koberger filed a handwritten petition for post-conviction relief saying that he wants to take that guilty plea back, and he's making some pretty serious allegations against his former defense team. Koberger claims his attorneys manipulated or coerced him into accepting the plea deal through what he describes as threats and unkept promises. Among other things, he claims that he was given inaccurate information about what his life would look like on death row and was promised that pleading guilty would lead to better prison conditions. But he also alleges ineffective assistance of counsel, claiming that his attorneys failed to properly investigate or explain potentially exculpatory evidence before convincing him to give up his right to a trial. Prosecutors want the entire petition thrown out without an evidentiary hearing. They argue Koberger's allegations are essentially bare assertions without admissible evidence to support them. And they point to the fact that during his plea hearing, Koberger repeatedly told Judge Hippler under oath that he understood the agreement, that no one had threatened or coerced him, that no promises had been made outside of the written agreement, and that he was pleading guilty voluntarily. But Judge Hippler isn't just dismissing this immediately. This week, he issued an order laying out the process for how Koberger's challenge will proceed. A status conference is now scheduled for June 3rd, 2027, and the court has reserved June 17th, 2027 for a potential evidentiary hearing. And I want to be really precise about that, because when this first blew up, all of the headlines this week made it sound like Koberger had already won the right to an evidentiary hearing. But that's not quite what the order says. When I pulled the actual documents, the judge specifically wrote that if an evidentiary hearing is granted, it will begin on June 17th. So Koberger has cleared enough of a procedural hurdle that the court is setting deadlines, allowing for potential witnesses and reserving a hearing date. But Judge Hippler could still agree with prosecutors and dismiss the petition without ever holding that evidentiary hearing. And now there's another twist. Koberger's newly appointed attorney is also asking for Judge Hippler himself to be removed from these proceedings. The defense points in part to comments that Hippler made when he sentenced Koberger, including questioning whether Koberger was capable of telling the truth and calling him a quote-unquote faceless coward. And that matters now, the defense argues, because Koberger's credibility could become central to deciding whether his claims about what happened behind the scenes during those plea negotiations are believable. Because if the judge is already saying he doesn't think he's capable of telling the truth, that's going to be a big deal during this potential hearing. His attorney is also asking to remove these post-conviction proceedings out of Ada County and back to Lata County, where the murders occurred. So almost a year after it appeared the Koberger case was completely over, we suddenly have several new questions. Will the judge even allow Koberger to present evidence supporting his claims? Will Judge Hippler remain on the case? And if Koberger somehow succeeds in withdrawing this guilty plea, which I don't think he should be able to, could he ultimately end up right back where he was before he made that deal, facing a murder trial and potentially facing the death penalty all over again?
We'll be right back.
If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. It's destroying athlete, creator, and YouTube maxer. YouTube Premium enhances how I use YouTube with awesome features like offline downloads, so I can download my favorite training videos before I hit the gym. So no Wi-Fi doesn't turn leg day into loading day. Plus, I get ad-free videos, background play, and so much more. YouTube Premium is like YouTube got some extra gains. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Haley Bailey. Okay, I need to tell you about something. I just got YouTube Premium. It's got tons of awesome features like offline downloads, so I can download my favorite videos before I travel and watch them whenever I don't have Wi-Fi. Because we all know airplane Wi-Fi is the worst. I get ad-free, I get background play, and there's like a ton more in there. You should try it. If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. So try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime. That's a mouthful.
Good news! Goodwill Columbus has opened a new store in Westerville. And with a new donation center, it's easier than ever to make a difference in your community. Bring your gently used clothing, furniture, electronics, and more to our donation drop-off. Each donation and purchase supports our mission to provide jobs, free job training, essential services, and more right here in Westerville. Drop your donations off at 60 East Schrock Road or learn more at goodwillcolumbus.org.
Hey, let's talk about something a lot of us deal with, thinning hair or hair loss. If that sounds familiar, CAPS has solutions. Their hair restoration treatments are personalized, designed to strengthen your existing hair, encourage regrowth, and improve scalp health. The providers at CAPS guide you every step of the way with advanced treatments for noticeable, long-lasting results. And when you book your first hair restoration appointment, you'll get a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Book today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
And now it's time to check in on the case that apparently will never, ever, ever go away. Alex Murdoch. And this update actually goes back to something I played for you after that August 14th pretrial hearing. The attorneys in that hearing were arguing about whether polygraph evidence could potentially come into Alex's retrial, specifically because Curtis Eddie Smith, aka Cousin Eddie, had been given a polygraph during the original investigation. And right in the middle of that argument, Dick Harpootlian stood up and said this.
I will tell you, Mr. Murdoch passed a polygraph. Flying colors. So, the same polygrapher. So, it may play a role in this trial.
Now, I remember when I heard that, I thought, wait a minute. Alex Murdoch took a polygraph about the murders and passed it with flying colors? When did that happen? Well, apparently, it didn't, because a few days later, Creighton Waters and the Attorney General's office filed an actual court document basically saying, hey, that ain't true. And the state did not mince words. They called Harpootlian's statement categorically false. According to prosecutors, Alex Murdoch has never taken a SLED polygraph about the murders of Maggie and Paul. He wasn't tested by the same polygraphers who tested Eddie Smith either. But here's where it gets even better. The state discovered that Alex actually had taken a polygraph, just not the one Harpootlian was talking about. The FBI gave Alex a polygraph in October of 2023, months after his murder trial. But that test had absolutely nothing to do with whether he killed Maggie and Paul. It was related to his financial crimes and whether Alex was being truthful about things like hidden assets and stolen money. And according to prosecutors, Alex failed it. The state says the results even indicated that Alex may have been attempting to use countermeasures during the test. So not only had Alex not passed a murder-related polygraph, quote-unquote, with flying colors, according to the only governmental polygraph prosecutors could actually identify, he failed. And after the state filed that correction, Harpootlian had to respond. So the next day, he sent a letter to Judge Deborah McCaslin acknowledging, quote, I realize I mistakenly conflated several facts and my statement was incorrect, end quote. He apologized to both the court and the state for the confusion, although he said he couldn't provide additional details about whatever polygraph information he had apparently confused. So, there you go. Mystery solved. Alex Murdoch did not pass a SLED polygraph about Maggie and Paul's murders with flying colors. And if you were listening to Court Report last week thinking, how in the world have we never heard about this before? Well, now we know why. And while we're already in the Murdoch universe, we might as well stay here for one more update, because Buster Murdoch just had a pretty significant win in his defamation lawsuit. Back in 2024, Buster sued several media companies over documentaries about his family that discussed the still unsolved death of Stephen Smith. Stephen was just 19 years old when his body was found in the middle of a rural road in Hampton County in July of 2015. Over the years, rumors circulated about a possible connection between Stephen and the Murdoch family, and specifically Buster. But Buster has repeatedly and emphatically denied having anything to do with Stephen's death, and importantly, he has never been charged or even publicly named as a suspect by law enforcement. His lawsuit argues that some of these documentaries went beyond simply reporting that those rumors existed and instead presented the information in a way that suggested to viewers that Buster actually was responsible for Stephen's death. Netflix and the other defendants tried to get the lawsuit dismissed. Their argument was essentially, we were reporting on something that was undeniably part of the public conversation surrounding this case, the fact that these theories and rumors existed, and that reporting is protected by the First Amendment and what's known as the fair report privilege. But this week, the judge refused to throw the case out. And one of the things that he focused on was the way that Netflix documentary was actually edited and presented. The judge said the producers took what he called creative liberties, combining interviews from law enforcement, members of the community, and journalists with information from official reports in a way that a reasonable viewer could potentially interpret as answering the very question the documentary claimed it was simply asking. Was Buster Murdoch involved in Stephen Smith's death? The judge also rejected the argument that everything in the documentary was automatically protected by the fair report privilege. That privilege protects fair and accurate reporting of what's contained in official public records. But Buster's argument is that the documentary didn't simply report what was in those records. It selectively combined that information with interviews and commentary to create a defamatory implication that he was responsible for Stephen's death. And at this stage of the case, the judge found that Buster has alleged enough for that claim to move forward. Now, that doesn't mean that the judge has ruled that Netflix defamed Buster. It doesn't mean that Buster won the lawsuit. It just means that Netflix and the remaining defendants were unsuccessful in getting the case thrown out before Buster gets the opportunity to prove his claims. Now, Buster is seeking actual and punitive damages, arguing that these accusations caused irreparable damage to his reputation and caused him mental anguish. And there is one other distinction here, because Buster originally sued several different companies. Earlier this year, he reached a confidential settlement with Warner Brothers, Blackfin, and the other defendants involved in separate Murdoch documentaries. Those claims were dismissed with prejudice, so those companies are done. But his case involving Netflix's Murdoch Murders, a Southern Scandal, along with claims against the Cinemart, Gannett, and journalist Michael DeWitt, is still alive. And after this week's ruling, Buster will now have the opportunity to continue trying to prove that those defendants crossed the line between reporting on rumors about Stephen Smith's death and actually presenting those rumors as fact. Next up, we have a trial coming next month that I think is worth putting on our radar. Caleb Flynn, a former American Idol contestant who once described himself as a music pastor, is getting ready to stand trial for the murder of his wife, 37-year-old Ashley Flynn. Ashley was a mother of two who worked as a substitute teacher and a seventh-grade volleyball coach in Tipp City, Ohio. On the morning of February 16th, Caleb called 911 with a terrifying story. He told the dispatcher that someone had broken into their home and shot his wife. Their two children were also inside the home at the time. But according to investigators, when they started going through the evidence, they determined that there had not been a break-in at all. Instead, police say that Caleb shot Ashley with a 9mm handgun and then staged the house to make it look like she had been killed during a burglary. He was arrested just a few days later and has pleaded not guilty. Caleb is now facing multiple charges, including aggravated murder, murder, felonious assault, tampering with evidence, and intimidation of a witness, attorney, or victim. And this case has already had some interesting pretrial battles. For one thing, prosecutors expect Caleb and Ashley's two children, who are just 9 and 12 years old, to testify at their father's trial. Prosecutors had asked the judge to allow special protections for the children while they testified, potentially including a screen that would keep them from having to see their father. But the judge denied that request, finding that prosecutors hadn't presented evidence showing that those measures were necessary. So, as things currently stand, if those children testify, they will have to do it with their father in the courtroom. And now we have another ruling. Caleb's attorneys asked to move his trial out of Miami County because they say that this case has received so much publicity that finding an impartial jury there may be impossible. They argued that this is a relatively small community. Both Caleb and Ashley were known locally, and residents have been exposed to months of television coverage, online reporting, and social media discussion about the case. Interestingly, prosecutors also acknowledged concerns about all of that publicity, but instead of moving the trial, they asked the judge to sequester the jury, meaning jurors would essentially be isolated from the outside information during the trial. The judge denied both requests. She said exposure to news coverage about a case doesn't automatically mean someone can't be an impartial juror. For the court to move the trial before even attempting jury selection, the defense would have to show that the publicity has been so pervasive and prejudicial that trying to seat an impartial jury would basically be futile. And she doesn't believe that they've shown that, at least not yet. And that yet is important because the judge denied the change of venue request without prejudice, which means Caleb's attorneys can bring it up again if they actually begin jury selection and discover that they can't find enough impartial jurors in Miami County. She also denied the state's request to sequester the jury, saying that prosecutors haven't shown that such an extreme measure is necessary at this point. So for now, the trial is staying exactly where it is. Caleb Flynn's trial is scheduled to begin September 17th in Miami County, Ohio, and we'll definitely be keeping an eye on this one, particularly once they start questioning potential jurors and we find out whether all of that pretrial publicity actually becomes part of the problem the defense says it's going to be. And finally, one more trial update, and I'm actually going to keep this one pretty short because I'm seriously considering doing an entire episode on this case. The first ever murder trial in the killing of Tupac Shakur is already nearing its end. Dwayne Keefe D. Davis is accused of orchestrating the 1996 drive-by shooting that killed Tupac in Las Vegas. Prosecutors are not arguing that Keefe D. was the person who actually pulled the trigger. Their case is that after Tupac and members of his entourage attacked Keefe D.'s nephew, Orlando Anderson, inside the MGM Grand that night, Keefe D. helped organize the retaliation, including obtaining the gun and providing it to the men inside the white Cadillac that later pulled alongside Tupac and Suge Knight. And after nearly 30 years, a huge part of the state's evidence against Keefe D is actually Keefe D himself. Jurors heard hours of his own words from police interviews, documentaries, public interviews, his memoir, and even jail calls. Prosecutors say Keefe D repeatedly admitted over the years that he was inside that Cadillac and played a role in what happened. The defense says those weren't confessions. They say that Keefe D was telling stories, just embellishing and exaggerating his involvement because there was money and notoriety to be gained from being a guy who knew what happened to Tupac. And that distinction may end up being absolutely critical because this week we heard something pretty significant from one of the former detectives who investigated the case. Retired Las Vegas homicide detective Dan Long testified that although he believed what Keefe D told investigators, he was never able to independently verify some pretty major pieces of that story, including that Keefe D was actually inside the Cadillac when Tupac was shot. And that is exactly what the defense wants this jury to focus on. Where's the evidence outside of Keefe D's own mouth? The prosecution rested this week after calling more than 24 witnesses. The defense then put on a very short case of its own, just 3 former Las Vegas police officers, and Keefe D himself did not testify. Both sides have now rested. Closing arguments are now scheduled for Monday, and then, nearly 30 years after Tupac Shakur was murdered, for the first time ever, a jury will decide whether someone is legally responsible for his death. And I'm intentionally just giving you the broad strokes here because there's so much more that came out during this trial, including some testimony and moments that I really want to dig into. So depending on what happens with this jury, don't be surprised if we come back to this one for a full episode in the coming weeks. And finally, we have a few juror notes before we get out of here. A quick update on Nick Reiner. The fight over whether he can access money from a family trust to help fund his defense is still unresolved. That hearing has now been continued until October. Meanwhile, his criminal case is moving forward and he's scheduled back in court for a pretrial hearing on September 15th. And in the Pike County Massacre case, George Billy Wagner, the final member of the Wagner family still awaiting trial, is now scheduled to go before a jury on January 11th, 2027. So that is definitely one that we'll be watching as we head into the new year. And finally, of course, Lindsey Clancy. After 5 weeks of testimony, dozens of witnesses, and a battle between experts over what was happening inside Lindsey's mind on January 24th, 2023, this case is officially in the hands of the jury. They deliberated Thursday and Friday without reaching a verdict. We did get our first little glimpse into what they're looking at, though. On Friday, the jury asked to examine some of the physical evidence, including the bags containing Lindsay's empty prescription bottles and the blood-stained knife recovered from her bedroom. Obviously, we can't read anything into that. We don't know why they wanted to see those particular exhibits or what it tells us about where they are in their deliberations, but we do know that they have a tremendous amount of evidence to work through and an incredibly consequential decision to make. They'll return Monday morning to continue deliberating. And you guys know how closely we've followed this case from beginning to end. So whenever that verdict comes down, we'll be here to talk about it. The full episodes and the deep dive into that case are available on 13th Juror podcast feed. And with that, I think we're going to call it a week. Thank you guys for sticking it out with me through the voice problems today. Hopefully by the next time you hear from me, I'll sound a little more like myself again. But there was just way too much happening in the courtroom this week to skip court report altogether. As always, thank you for listening, thank you for being here, and I'll see you back in the jury box next time. So that's your court report for this week. I'll be back next week with the latest developments. Until then, keep asking questions, keep looking at the evidence, and decide for yourself what you believe. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator and host of the 13th Juror podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow the show on your favorite podcast platform and leave a rating or review. For additional episodes, case updates, and more information about the podcast, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com. The evidence has been presented, the arguments have been made, and now comes the same question faced by every juror. What do you believe?
Good news! Goodwill Columbus has opened a new store in Westerville. And with a new donation center, it's easier than ever to make a difference in your community. Bring your gently used clothing, furniture, electronics, and more to our donation drop-off. Each donation and purchase supports our mission to provide jobs, free job training, essential services, and more right here in Westerville. Drop your donations off at 60 East Schrock Road or learn more at goodwillcolumbus.org.
Ever thought about Botox but worry you'll look, well, overdone? You're not alone. That's exactly why so many people choose Caps. Their approach is all about keeping your expression natural because Botox shouldn't freeze your face. It should refresh it. At Caps, treatments are performed by licensed nurses known for precise and subtle refined enhancements, all overseen by nationally ranked plastic surgeons. Now's the perfect time to start Botox. Book your first appointment and receive a $50 Caps MedSpa gift card. Schedule today at experiencecaps.com. Caps, where confidence begins.